What happened to them? It remains to consider what happened to all of these people. Here again, we have a situation in which there exists much less data than one would hope for. However, we have enough information to reconstruct what happened to an extent suitable for our purposes. Actually, we must consider several possibilities in this respect. The following are the reasonable possibilities. 1. The Germans liquidated many while in retreat, because these people could be considered manpower to be employed against the Germans. It is necessary to consider this as a reasonable possibility because we have noted that the Germans had, indeed, considered this aspect of the matter seriously enough to make it difficult for Jews to emigrate from Europe. However, there are two things working strongly against the possibility that the Germans liquidated on a significant scale while in retreat. First, the most able workers, who were also of military age, had already been picked out for labor, and were being employed by the Germans in various ways. Second, and most importantly and simply, if the Germans had carried out such liquidations on a large scale, the Allies would have charged them with it. The Allies would have had material for legitimate extermination charges rather than the gas chamber nonsense. While the evidence indicated that the German authorities did not carry out large-scale liquidations of Jews while in retreat, common sense and a feel for the conditions that existed should cause us to assume that there were numerous massacres of Jews carried out by individuals and small groups acting on their own. Some German, Hungarian or Romanian troops, and some East European civilians, their anti-Jewish feelings amplified by the disastrous course of the war, no doubt made attacks on Jews at the time of the German retreats. It is known that earlier in the war, when East Europeans had attempted to start pogroms, the German authorities had restrained and suppressed them. However, under conditions of chaotic retreat, the Germans were probably much less concerned with anti-Jewish pogroms. 2. The Russians liquidated many. We list this only because Russia is such an enigma, and its actions in the population's area often seem very arbitrary. However, there is no evidence for liquidations at the hands of the Russians, and one should doubt this possibility. 3. Many perished on account of conditions in the camps or ghettos. This is a most serious possibility. We have seen that health conditions can be very unstable in camps, and that the situation can be very sensitive to any sort of chaos or shortage of necessities. Moreover, we have observed that the ghetto conditions, whether the Germans were at fault or, as the Germans claimed, the Jews were responsible, were favorable to epidemics even early in the war, when the Germans had the general situation under control in other respects. Therefore, there is a good possibility that many Jews in ghettos perished in the chaotic conditions that accompanied the German retreats. Also, Korzen believes that many of the 1940 exiles to Russia died in the Russian camps they were sent to, so it is possible that many ghetto Jews perished on account of Soviet ways of administering the ghettos after they fell into Russian hands. 4. Many were dispersed throughout the Soviet Union and integrated into Soviet life somewhere. This is a most likely possibility, because it is well established that the Soviet Union encouraged the absorption of Jews during and immediately after the war. For example, we have noted that this was the policy exercised toward the 1940 deportees. Another example is what happened with respect to the Carpatho-Ukraine, before the war a province of Czechoslovakia, and annexed by the Soviet Union after the war. 10,000 Jews, former residents of the Carpatho-Ukraine, had the status of refugees in Czechoslovakia in the spring of 1946. Russia insisted that these Jews be repatriated to the Soviet Union. Although such a step was contrary to the existing agreements on refugees, the Soviet pressure on President Benesh was great enough to force him to yield. One should also note the existence, within the Soviet Union, of the specifically Jewish autonomous state of Birabidzhan, which is in the Soviet Far East, on the Amur River on the border of Manchuria. Birabidzhan had been established by the Soviets in 1928 as a Jewish state. Immediately after the war, there existed in New York the Einstein Fund of Ambijan, acronym for American Birabidzhan Committee, whose purpose was, quote, to help refugee colonization of Birabidzhan, unquote. There were other operations in New York, which aided Jews resettled in Birabidzhan immediately after World War II. There were also Jewish organizations, such as the Joint Distribution Committee, which aided Jews in other parts of the Soviet Union, and there also existed in New York the Committee for Aid to Minsk and neighboring towns. There also existed UNRWA programs in White Russia, Belorussia, and Ukraine, which will be commented on below. These efforts to aid Jewish refugees in the Soviet Union had the public support of prominent Jews. For example, Albert Einstein expressed appreciation to the Soviet government for helping, quote, hundreds of thousands of Jewish people, unquote, by giving them a home in the USSR. While the Soviet Union encouraged the absorption of Jews, it also made a specific agreement with the communist government of Poland for the repatriation of those who had been Polish citizens on September 17, 1939. The agreement, made in July 1945, specifically included those resident on territory annexed by the Soviet Union in 1940, and provided that such people could either elect Soviet citizenship or Polish citizenship. With respect to Jews, it was eventually decided that the deadline for making the choice was June 30, 1946. As we noted in Chapter 1, page 36, Reitlinger concedes that the post-war Jewish population of the Soviet Union might very well have exceeded the pre-war figure, on account of the addition of Polish, and Baltic and other Jews. He regards the Jewish Observer estimate of 500,000 Polish Jews, who elected to remain in the Soviet Union, as quote-unquote very conservative, and concedes huge and insuperable uncertainties in this connection. Thus, although the Russians were willing to let Polish Jews leave before the June 30, 1946 deadline, they nevertheless encouraged their absorption into the Soviet Union. This could account for an enormous number of the Jews who had been resettled to the east by the Germans. It is pointless, however, to try to infer anything from alleged population statistics offered by the Russians, or by Jewish organizations. 5. Many of the uprooted Jews might have returned to their original homes or at least to their original homelands in Europe. We have seen that the Russians were willing to allow Polish Jews to leave the Soviet Union, and we should assume that a similar policy was practiced toward Jews of other nationalities. It is only possible but not probable that the Soviet Union absorbed all of the Jews who had been deported east by the Germans from Germany, the Netherlands, etc. At first thought, it might appear that the clearly logical course after the war for any uprooted Jew would have been to return to his original country of residence. This is not the case, however, for various reasons. For one thing, in perhaps the majority of cases there was nothing to return to. The main reason for this was the German program called Aktion Reinhardt, in which Jews deported to the east were deprived of almost all of their property, their furniture, any livestock, business property, their jewelry, any clothing they could not carry as luggage, and all but about $25 of any ordinary currency they had, were simply confiscated in the course of resettlement. Some of the business property might have been resettled with them. The camps at Lublin and Auschwitz were principal gathering and processing points for much of this property, wherever it had actually been confiscated. Thus, many Jews, having neither property nor relatives at their original homes, had no very compelling reasons for returning to them. The German program had truly been one of uprooting. Another aspect of the situation was that, in late 1945 and in 1946, there was much talk about anti-Jewish pogroms allegedly occurring with great frequency in Poland and other East European countries. If these reports were true, then the pogroms were a powerful inducement to the Jews to leave. If these reports were merely Zionist propaganda having little, if any, basis in fact, then one can infer that the Zionists were engaging in operations designed to move Jews out of Eastern Europe. Thus, whether the reports of pogroms were true or false, they suggest a movement of Jews out of Eastern Europe. At the Yalta meeting in 1945, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin had agreed that, quote, it would be impossible for Jewish refugees to return to Poland and be reintegrated into its normal life, unquote. While it is certain that many Jews returned to their homelands, there were solid facts and also, apparently, much propaganda discouraging them from doing so. If this is true, and if it is also true that a significant number of Polish Jews left Soviet territory, then many of them must have proceeded through Poland to other destinations. This is the case. The Zionist political leadership had other destinations in mind for them. 6. Many of the Jews eventually resettled neither in the Soviet Union nor in their original countries but elsewhere, mainly in the US and Palestine. We all know this to be true, but there is some uncertainty in the numbers involved, principally in the case of the US immigrants. Until November 1943, the US Immigration and Naturalization Service recognized a category Hebrew among races and peoples, but in that month, this practice was stopped, and no official records of Jewish immigration have been kept since then. Another problem in accounting in detail for Jewish movements around the time of the end of the war is that we run right into the War Refugee Board and the UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, in attempting to examine this subject. It will be recalled that the WRB was set up in early 1944 as an apparently joint venture of the U.S. State, Treasury, and War Departments, but that it was, in fact, under the control of Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau. The board was granted the extraordinary power of appointing special attachés with diplomatic status. Another very irregular feature was that the WRB worked very closely with private organizations. Collaboration with the Joint Distribution Committee and the World Jewish Congress and several other Jewish and Zionist organizations was extensive. Some non-Jewish organizations were also involved, notably the American Friends Service Committee. The WRB and the three U.S. government departments involved with the WRB were specifically, quote, authorized to accept the services or contributions of private persons or organizations, unquote. We therefore have a rather slippery entity involved here, engaged in both propaganda and relief work, with the rights of a government operation when an official status seemed convenient, and the rights of a private organization when a private status was advantageous. Relief activities were carried on by the WRB from about mid-1944 to mid-1945, at which time the operations of an international character fell almost entirely into the hands of the UNRWA. This organization had been set up in November 1943, and had operated until March 1949. Its first director, appointed by Roosevelt, was Herbert Lehman, ex-governor of New York State and a leading New Deal Democrat. Roosevelt's reported logic for choosing Lehman was as follows, quote, "It would be a fine object lesson in tolerance and human brotherhood to have a Jew head up this operation, and I think Herbert would be fine," unquote. Lehman was succeeded in early 1946 by Fiorello LaGuardia, ex-mayor of New York City. Although LaGuardia's father was not Jewish, and he naturally found it profitable to court the huge New York Italian vote, LaGuardia really counts as a Jewish Zionist politician, and is essentially treated as such by the Encyclopedia Judaica. Thus, we can be sure that the crowd involved here is basically the same as with the WRB. Also, we again have a slippery entity, this time because it is a so-called international organization. For example, when Congress demanded in September 1945 that the General Accounting Office be allowed to examine the UNRWA operations, the U.S. was said to be paying about two-thirds of the costs of UNRWA, but the fraction was probably somewhat higher. Lehman told it to mind its own business. The UNRWA operations were far-flung. Most of the UNRWA aid went to Eastern Europe, and the amount sent to Poland was second only to that sent to China. Aid was also sent to White Russia and Ukraine. By mid-1944, the WRB and the UNRWA were operating a large system of refugee camps in North Africa, Italy, and Palestine. These camps were almost exclusively for Jews. Starting in 1944, extensive evacuations of Jews from Europe to these camps were in progress. Many were evacuated from the Balkans via Istanbul, and there was also a Black Sea route through Istanbul. Entry into the US or countries of South America was sought and obtained for many of these people, while the war was still in progress. It was in this context that the camp at Oswego, New York, right next to the Canadian border, was established. In addition, many who had not initially been put into one of the camps in Palestine managed to reach that destination anyway. After Germany collapsed, the UNRWA-administered DP, displaced persons camps, mainly in the British and American zones of occupation in German and Austria. Of course, there were many non-Jews in these camps, but the Jews had a privileged position, and in many cases were quartered in houses or hotels, which had been requisitioned for them. The UNRWA operations in Germany were one of the scandals of the occupation era. Notorious were the raids on German homes for the purposes of quote-unquote rescuing children. It had been the Nazi policy in Eastern Europe, when orphans fell into their hands, to conduct a racial examination in order to select Aryan orphans for adoption by German families. These children were being raised exactly as German children were, and became the innocent victims of the UNRWA terror. It is not known what happened to them. The behavior of the DPs in the UNRWA camps was abysmal. As the most prominent historian of the U.S. military government in Germany wrote, quote, "They not only consumed large quantities of food, but they exhibited many of the psychoneurotic traits, which must be expected from people who have undergone the tribulations that many of the displaced persons suffered. It was commonplace for them to allege that they were not receiving the consideration that they deserved from the Allied authorities. They often objected to the camps in which they were living, maintaining that it reflected on their position to be lodged in camps. Some urged that the best German houses be cleared of their occupants, and placed at the disposal of the displaced persons, especially the Jews. They refused to assist in some instances in keeping their quarters reasonably habitable, taking the position that it was not their responsibility to make any effort to help themselves. During this period, the actual care of the displaced persons was handled for some months by UNRWA, but final responsibility remained with military government, and it had to give attention to the charges made in the press as to inadequate treatment. Moreover, the displaced persons continued their underground war with the German population, despite all their promises and the efforts exerted by UNRWA and the American Army personnel. Forages into the countryside never ceased. Some displaced persons took advantage of every opportunity to pick a quarrel with the Germans. With German property looted, German lives lost, and German women raped almost every day by the displaced persons, widespread resentment developed among the populace, especially when they could not defend themselves against the firearms which the displaced persons managed to obtain. Unquote. In one well-publicized incident, Jewish and Polish DPs, with the assistance of some U.S. Army personnel, forced German townspeople to dig up recently buried bodies and, while beating and kicking the Germans, forced them to remove decayed flesh and clean the bones.